episode 299.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. So I had an interesting conversation at the end of my workday. One of my cellmates was talking about aliens, which of course led to Roswell, some episodes of X-Files, Star Trek. Anyway, we ended up with some interesting thoughts about life beyond the stars. So this week, I thought I'd pose the question, do aliens exist? Or put it another way, is there life beyond Earth? Well, according to a number of works of fiction, the cosmos is teeming with life. There are many here on Earth who swear they've had an encounter with an extraterrestrial, be it craft or alien. But more on that later. Now, some of my listeners to Radio Free Thinker may be aware, I have a degree in philosophy. Well, students of philosophy think differently than regular folk. Instead of talking about the accuracy of Star Trek or the latest propulsion engines or if we'll ever be invaded like they were in the Body Snatchers, no, I thought the first question should be, what is life, at least as we know it? So obviously, we're life. Dogs, flies, even bacteria seem to be life. But these are all things that we know implicitly as alive. But again, the philosopher in me asks, why do we say they're alive? Well, often there are three criteria that apply to life. First, there must be some capacity to reproduce. There should be an ability to grow. And lastly, there needs to be the ability to metabolize, to convert energy into, well, life or amplification, if you will, be that offspring or increased size. In fact, one of the criteria of death is the cessation of cell division. We stop eating, and more commonly what comes to mind, we stop breathing. We often may include decay as part of the definition of death, but to be pedantic, technically, we're decaying all the time. Cells are dying, we're food for a host of microorganisms, and occasionally not-so-microorganisms, bloody mosquitoes. While alive, we don't notice this, with some rare exceptions, because we're replacing those dead cells, killing evasive pathogens, and swatting those mosquitoes. Okay, so we seem to have three rough points. We could quibble about how much growth qualifies as life. One could argue that a life form could be static in size and still be alive. But if we include reproduction, that offspring would seem to be, at least initially, part of the parent and thusly a growth of a form at least. But another argument could be made about reproduction. There is one animal form that is commonplace but lacks the ability to reproduce. And that quasi-life form is the lily virus. These buggers lack the machinery to reproduce. That makes them completely reliant on others to do the reproduction for them. For those who may not know, a virus has DNA, the blueprint, if you will, for making baby viruses. They also have the ability to create certain proteins, enzymes, and the like. This they use to breach a cell's defenses so it can invade the cell and take over its reproductive equipment. It then swaps the original DNA for its own viral DNA, and now the cell starts churning out baby viruses, which eventually cause the cell to explode and thus, to continue our metaphor, giving birth to a new generation of viruses. Lacking the ability to grow on their own, viruses actually fail two of our criteria of life, reproduction and growth. So, although they contain DNA and interact with life, they themselves are widely not considered to be alive or a life form. So the term quasi-life form is used. So we seem to have a robust enough set of criteria that we can then ask, what is life like here on Earth? Is there any other commonalities that may not be necessary but correlate with life? Well, in shows like Star Trek and other sci-fi offerings, our life type is often referred to as a carbon-based life form. Why? Well, the chemistry of life, again, at least here on Earth, is completely and totally dependent on organic chemistry. Organic, not in the sense of being alive, although the etymology of the term does have its origins there. The fact is that almost all chemistry involving carbon is organic chemistry. Carbon itself, and the vast majority of chemistry in living beings, is organic chemistry. Carbon itself is a remarkable element. It has 4 free electrons and 4 empty electron slots. You see, what makes a molecule is the ability of elements to combine together to react. The most common way for these elements to hook up is to share electrons. What do I mean share? Well, the best way to think about this is to use the classic model of shells. Each atom's nucleus, the nucleus is the heart of the atom where you find protons and neutrons, well, they're surrounded by shells. Each shell has a set number of electrons it can hold. With the exception of the first layer, which has 2 slots, each shell has 8 holes. And atoms prefer to either have a full shell or an empty shell. Anything else makes them unstable and reactive. So atoms with valence is the technical term for these holes, if they have a valence of less than 4, they tend to give electrons away to achieve a stable empty shell. Well, to be fair, it's a stable full shell below that they want, but it works out to be the same. And for those with more than 4, well, they tend to take electrons from the neighbors. This makes most elements comfortable with bonding either up or down, giving or taking, but rarely both. However, carbon has 4. It is the bisexual element in that it will swing both ways, willing to take 4 electrons or give them away with no preference. This means that carbon chemistry is far more varied than most other elements. This is one of the reasons organic chemistry is such a huge field of study, and why it has come to dominate life. A living organism must do a lot of chemistry to eat, move, think, grow. You get the picture. So, as far as we know, all life in the universe must be carbon-based. But hold on a minute, you might say. Don, I watched Star Trek too, and I remember silicon-based life forms. And when I went and checked the periodic table, I see that silicon also has that magic 4 valence. So couldn't life on another planet be silicon-based? Could there even be silicon-based life here? And we just haven't noticed it, you know, because carbon and silicon are periodic table kin. Well, it is true, they are periodic table kin in that they have the same number of free electrons in their outer shell. And with regards to speculation that silicon-based life is on Earth, well, we have yet to observe it. And this is a bit of our ability to observe it that will resurface later, but irrespective of that point, there's another problem with silicon, also germanium, tin, lead, and thorium. Although they have the same bisexual, or more properly put, bidirectional outer shells, their ability to react is limited. That is, carbon reacts with other elements. It trades electrons easily, but it does so, unlike the others, requiring less energy, pressure, temperature, and that kind of thing. Its periodic kin require more energy to do the same kind of chemistry. Also, the larger size makes a difference, meaning that silicon, although similar in structure to carbon, is far more limited in its chemical flexibility. The universe has dictated that carbon is just special. Not only does it have the right number of bonds, but it's small enough to use them in more effective ways. The chemistry just doesn't work for the other elements. When I started reading about quantum effects, well, let's just leave this question at a just-because answer. And to give you an example, when you combine 4 carbon atoms with oxygen, you get carbon monoxide, a gas that has a variety of characteristics that makes it easier to use. It flows, it interacts, it's easier to mix up. However, with silicon, you get silica, or glass, which is rigid, less flexible, and less useful. Perhaps under the right temperature and pressure, you could get a gaseous form of silica, but that doesn't solve the other problems. That said, some hypotheses of biogenesis suggest that silicon in the form of clays did play a pivotal role in the formation of life, but did not actually form life itself. I should take another moment to discuss how life started here on Earth. We know with a large degree of certainty, at least in the big picture sense, how life evolved from a single-celled prokaryote to plants and animals that we see now. We are, however, completely unsure about how the leap from chemistry to biology happened. How life was evolved from non-living chemicals. Let's start with evolution. Basically, evolution is change over time. That is why it's such an oft-used word. Cars evolve, TV shows evolve, I've evolved as a person. But today on Radio Freethinker, I'm thinking about biological evolution. We are not worried so much about that change happened, but what mechanism allowed that change. We know how basic biological evolution works. You have reproduction, variation, and selection. So, having children is reproduction. However, they're not perfect copies. There are mutations and anomalies. Epigenetics has its hand in how genes are expressed. So what you get is a variation of the original. Then, with this variation, we get selection. Some of these variants have fatal flaws and they die. Most have no effect, and some are better adapted to their environment. They are more likely to have more offsprings or to have greater reproductive success. I should point out, I just misspoke there when I said more offspring. This differs from reproductive success because you may have less children, but if they are more likely to reproduce themselves, well, that may be more adaptive than having lots of kids where most of them die off before they can reproduce themselves. Also, note I said adaptive and not better. We like to think evolution is progressive, each iteration better than the previous, but not necessarily so. Just think about how aquatic life evolved limbs to walk on land. Let's call that a progressive move. Then only to evolve limblessness, to return to the sea. We could see that as regressive, and yet it made whales and dolphins more adaptive to their environment. Now in biology, there tends to be a benefit to create more complex adaptations. But life, biology, was not created. Sorry, Jesus. It arose from chemical evolution. However, chemistry has a tendency towards simplicity. Complex structures tend to be less stable and less dissolve. So evolution in chemistry, that which would lead to biology, would be a chemical system with repetitive production that had variations where themselves, like their biological analogs, selected over time. You know what? Let's pause there. I don't think I'm going to get this out right. And there's a perfect piece of web wisdom that'll explain it, at least better than I think I can. So let's listen in.
Scientists have reason to think that the first living cells on Earth came about through a natural process called chemical evolution. The word evolution simply means change over time. Biological evolution deals with changes in things which are able to reproduce. Living creatures make copies of themselves. The change over time that we see in biological evolution is not just random change. Oftentimes, it is adaptive change. Populations become better able to survive and reproduce within their environments. When conditions are right, biological evolution can even drive a species to develop brand new characteristics and abilities. For this to happen, biological evolution typically requires three conditions: reproduction, variation, and selection. Let's see how this works. Many species of holly have smooth-edged leaves. English holly, however, is covered in spikes which protect the plant from deadly predators. How did these weapons first evolve? Well, when a holly plant reproduces, its offspring often show random variation. They are slightly different from their parents and slightly different from each other. In a forest filled with grazing animals, individual plants which happen to be harder to eat than their siblings are more likely to grow up and have children of their own. Nature, simply by being difficult to survive in, selects who gets to reproduce and pass on their new traits and who does not. In this case, mutations which simply cause the veins of these leaves to extend past their edges gave rise to a brand new weapon. The discovery of biological evolution was an incredible breakthrough in science. It explained how new complex traits and abilities develop naturally in living things. The problem is, biological evolution depends on reproduction in order to work. Reproduction, however, is an extremely complex process in and of itself. This begs the question, how did reproduction first evolve? To try and solve this mystery, many scientists are looking into chemical evolution. Chemical evolution refers to changes in things that need not be capable of reproduction. Examples could be individual molecules or entire chemical systems. A chemical system is a group of molecules that interact with each other. Molecules, structures, and chemical systems almost always evolve or change over time, but they often evolve towards simplicity. Solid iron corrodes into rust when it comes in contact with water. Proteins break down when exposed to too much heat.
Ouch!
If simple chemistry is to give rise to something advanced enough to reproduce, There must be situations in which chemical systems can grow in complexity, form new structures, and gain new functions. In order for this to happen, reproduction, which is needed in biological evolution, can be replaced with a much simpler process, repetitive production. On planet Earth and all throughout the universe, powerful natural events take place in regular cycles. The heating, and then the cooling of day and night. The repetitive eruptions of volcanic geysers. The rise and then the fall of ocean tides. These events repetitively produce or give birth to new molecules and chemical systems. These products increase over time and often develop new abilities as they interact with their environment. Let's see an example of how this process works. This here is a special molecule called a fatty acid. It's a collection of carbon atoms, hydrogen atoms, and oxygen atoms all stuck together in a specific pattern. Fatty acids are one of many complex molecules that living cells use inside their bodies. They build fatty acids with atoms they get from their environment. Scientists used to think that living cells were the only things able to consistently build fatty acids, but check this out. Lab experiments have shown that if simple common gases, carbon monoxide and hydrogen, are heated up with minerals like those found in the Earth's crust, a variety of complex carbon molecules, including fatty acids, begin to grow. Living cells are not needed. This can happen naturally in underground chambers, heated by the Earth's magma. As pressure builds, these molecules can belch up into pools of water, where a simplified version of natural selection then takes over. Most particles blasted into water will either float or they will sink. Nature selects against them staying in the watery environment. Fatty acids, however, remain suspended in warm water, growing in number as the cycle repeats. When fatty acid concentrations are high enough, they bunch together, automatically self-assembling into a stable ball. This happens because water molecules are attracted to the oxygen heads of fatty acids, sort of like a magnet, but water repels their oily carbon tails. When fatty acids pass near each other, their tails are pushed together by water, eventually forming a ball. As fatty acid collections continue to increase, they join together to make large skins. If fluctuations in these skins happen to make the edges touch, water forces those edges to fuse together. The end result is a stable hollow container, similar to the membrane or skin of a living cell. These containers have a brand new ability. They can trap other molecules inside, acting as an entirely new environment for chemical evolution to continue working within. It's important to note that these membranes do not qualify as living creatures. They can't reproduce on their own the same way living cells do. That said, the development of these membranes, along with many other molecules and chemical systems that scientists have observed, demonstrate an extremely important principle. Chemical evolution can give rise to new characteristics and abilities. Because of this, scientists hypothesize that under the right circumstances, chemical evolution could give rise to systems that are fully capable of reproduction. If they are correct, this would bridge the gap between chemical evolution and biological evolution, demonstrating that chemistry can indeed give rise to life.
Of course, I have assumed that life evolved here on Earth. Well, there is the idea of panspermia. That is, life evolved on another cosmic body, and Earth was, how shall I say, contaminated with life? Perhaps from a comet impact or meteorite. Some people argued that life may have evolved first on Mars, which would have been conductive to life, as we know it, sooner than Earth. Basically, Mars had a thick atmosphere billions of years ago, and likely cooled down sooner than Earth thanks to not having been bit by Theia that created our moon, meaning life could have had a few million years head start on Mars. How did life get to Earth? Well, you may not know this, but a meteoric impact can be so explosive so as to launch rocks back into space. So it is possible, No, not possible. Actual. There are a number of examples of Martian rocks or meteorites on Earth. Mars was struck, its debris rocketed into space, and it has landed on Earth. Now, the hard part is surviving the journey from Mars to Earth. You see, there's no air in space, so life would need to be able to survive a vacuum to get here. And there's also a great amount of radiation space than found on the surface of a planet. Radiation destroys DNA and life. And then there's the time factor. It would take a couple of years at least for a Martian life form to make the journey to Earth. That's a long time to go without eating, to survive the previously mentioned hardships. Could life survive that? Well, as it turns out, there are several examples of life surviving the harshest conditions here on Earth. There have been experiments on an eight-legged, water-dwelling, segmented microanimal called the tardigrade, also known as the water bear, or my favorite, moss piglets. They were exposed to outer space, and, well, having conducted the experiment on the water bears, they managed to survive the vacuum of space for over a week. These guys have been frozen, boiled, irradiated, and still survived. And then there's a class of bacteria we call extremophiles. These critters make their homes in waters that are above the boiling point. Some live in nuclear waste pools, some in highly acidic waters. They've even resurrected 500 million-year-old bacteria spores. So a Mars-to-Earth trip seems possible, if nothing else. The universe is about 14 billion years old. The Earth is a little over 4 billion. So it is possible, at least in theory, for life to evolve on another solar system, hell, another galaxy, and land here on Earth. Of course, as far as we're concerned, that only changes the location for the origin of life. The how question is the same. So we can now add to our criteria for life that it needs to be carbon-based. That said, it does not have to be anything like our life here on Earth, beyond the basic chemistry. Like, our life is also based on DNA and RNA, but that may be unique in the universe. So let's return to our question. Could life exist beyond Earth? What would it require? Well, carbon is fairly ubiquitous in the universe, so that seems hardly a limiting factor. But there also seems to be a need for some form of solvent. That is, we have our wonderful organic chemistry, but to move these compounds around, like sugar or protein or like, well, you need to have a medium that can transport them without altering them or destroying these compounds, or conversely allowing them to interact better. Life on Earth has chosen water as the medium of choice. And as it turns out, it seems water is as unique in the universe for its flexibility and utility as carbon. One example of water's uniqueness lies in the fact that it is lighter as a solid than as a liquid. This has been very important in the preservation of life on Earth. You see, if ice were heavier than water, it would sink. The remaining water is still exposed to the cold, which will freeze, and this continues until there's nothing left but solid ice. However, the way ice really works is it floats. This means that ice actually insulates the water beneath it, preventing or at least slowing it from freezing. So large bodies of water will never freeze over. Well, there is a caveat. There needs to be some internal heat source, otherwise eventually it will freeze all the way down. This has been a lifesaver because there have been a few instances when our planet was transformed into what they call Snowball Earth. Times when our orb became a deep freeze where all land and surface water were frozen. But thanks to the insulating ability of ice and geothermic vents, life survived this deep freeze to reconquer the world once the temperatures returned to quote normal. So from our experience, another criteria for life forms seems to be the presence of water. Actually, I should make explicit that has been implicit so far. When we talk about the criteria of life, this is based upon all the examples of life that we know about, which, on a planet count, we have a sample size of one, the Earth. A good skeptic would red flag any study or claim that relied on a single sample. That's akin to anecdotal evidence. But it is, so far, all we have. That said, it is important to note that we have one solar object that has a liquid solvent on its surface outside of Earth. It is the only place in the universe we know where there are lakes and rivers, and that's Titan, the famous moon of Saturn. Of course, the downside being its lakes and rivers do not flow with water, but methane. This is because the surface temperature of Titan is minus 179 degrees Celsius, or minus 290 Fahrenheit, allowing methane to be in liquid form. That said, we have hopes that there may be a kind of life there. Thanks to the new chemistry and thick atmosphere of Titan, it has an abundance of organic molecules and compounds. These, as already mentioned, are the foundations of life here on Earth. Now, if there was life on Titan, it would be very different than that found on this planet, and that would be fantastic. So, let us exclude Titan for now, because any life on it would be so unlike what we know, we may not even know it when we saw it. So, returning to our question, is there life out there? Well, you might be thinking I'm going to reference some planet orbiting Alpha Centauri, or something similar, but no, with the criteria we have set, you may or may not be surprised to know that there are a number of candidate locations for possible life right here in our own solar system. Although it would be hard for life to exist on Mars, there is water there, and if life evolved during a more hospitable period, enough to evolve extremophiles, well, there are bacteria here on Earth that would likely survive on Mars. There are bacteria that live in rock miles down below the surface of the Earth. So it is possible that if we dug down a few feet on Mars, we may find primitive life. And not only on Mars. One of the most exciting discoveries in the last few decades was that the most likely place to find life in our solar system was not on planets, but on the moons. Moons like Europa, Enceladus, Ganymede, and Callisto are all believed to have huge water oceans. But you might be wondering, how? I just said that the surface temperature of Titan was minus 179 Celsius. So the surfaces of these moons I mentioned must be rock hard, even if made of water. And they're small, so yes, Earth has a lot of heat at its core from its formation, but Mars has completely solidified. It's got a cold center, so shouldn't these small moons be rock hard through and through? Well, that was the thinking, until we noticed during our first flyby of Io that it had volcanoes, sulfur volcanoes, but nonetheless, it had to have an active core. Europa showed signs of upwelling from a hot interior. So how could these moons generate heat to keep their inners warm? We can give credit to gravity. We're all aware of tides here on Earth. This rising and lowering of the world's oceans is caused by the gravitational pull of our moon on Earth. It should be noted, the moon has tides as well. Not tides of water, but actual rock is moving up and down with the tides. And I guess to be fair, it's happening here, but not nearly as noticeably. But due to the greater flexibility of water, we see these actions better, and the gravitational tug of war between Earth and the Moon is, to be fair, relatively small, but enough, causing the tide at the Bay of Fundy to shift over 55 feet each tide cycle. However, Europa, Ganymede, and the other, well, they orbit gas giants. Giants have huge gravitational effects on their Moon. This flexing of the interior of these moons is sufficient to generate heat that is likely to give them, if not molten cores, cores warm enough to fuel those huge oceans, which are not surface oceans we are familiar with, but subsurface oceans. That is, the surface of these moons are covered by miles of ice. Underneath all that ice, though, is likely to be liquid water. Scientists are conflicted as to whether this liquid water is of the type that flows out of our taps, or more like slush that you'd find in a Slurpee. One of the great adventures that awaits humanity in the coming decades will be a mission to these moons, to see if there's life in them there moons. There are ongoing plans for a mission to Europa to send a kind of submarine to explore the subsurface oceans. Finding signs of life may be easier on Enceladus and Ganymede because these have giant geysers that shoot water miles into space. We could simply fly by with a big net to sample that water for signs of life. We might find life itself being tossed into space. Without leaving our solar system, we have a number of candidate bodies where the possibility of life exists. Well, what about beyond our solar system? Do we know of any planets beyond our solar system? We'll answer that question after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back, asking the question, do we know of any planets beyond our solar system? Well, It may surprise our listeners to Radio Free Thinker to know, but it was not until 1988 that a group of Canadian astronomers discovered the first exoplanet, of a kind that would be later termed hot Jupiters. Prior to the Space Observatory Kepler, which went into service in 2009, we had discovered about 300 or 400 extrasolar or exoplanets. Since Kepler, that number has risen to well over 1,000 confirmed, with an additional 3,500 plus suspected, but not yet confirmed. How, you might ask, do we know there are planets out there? Well, there are several methods used to detect these exoplanets. There are a few, like a dozen or so, that can actually be observed directly. Another way of discovering planets is to look for the wobble. What do I mean by wobble? Well, some of us will recall from our classes in classical Newton physics, gravity is everywhere, and that each object, irrespective of size, exerts a gravitational pull on every other object. In our context, the Sun's gravitational pull on the Earth causes us to orbit the Sun. However, the Earth also exerts a gravitational force on the Sun, pulling it ever so slightly towards us. This pullback causes the Sun to wobble. If the mass of the exoplanet is sufficient, we can observe this pull. This is how most of the pre-Kepler planets were observed. For our purpose of finding life on other worlds, this technique does not identify many hospitable planets because the planets usually tend to be massive, as in Jupiter size, and initially had to orbit close to that host planet Sun. Hot Jupiter was coined because these massive planets orbited close to the Sun, often very much closer than Mercury currently orbits the Sun. Another method that is used is called the transit method. When we observe a star, its light output is relatively constant. However, when a planet transits or crosses between us and the star, that star luminosity drops. If this drop is periodic enough, it is classified as a planet that is orbiting its star. Of course, the problem with this method is that the exosolar system has to be aligned with Earth in such a way as to have the planet pass between us and its star. That said, there are so many stars out there, if you have enough time and you look at a big enough slice of the sky, you will discover, or should I put, we have discovered thousands of possible planets, tripling the number of candidate planets and doubling those confirmed. That said, finding a planet is like finding a rock. Great, but we're actually looking for diamonds. There are far rarer to find, and so, just finding lots of planets is only really a start. There may be some exotic life forms that can evolve in hydrogen plasma or liquid methane, but based on what we know about chemistry, the possibility of life evolving from an Earth-like planet is much more likely. One could say that every life-bearing planet we know of is Earth-like. What makes Earth special? Well, it exists in what's called the Goldilocks zone. That is, it orbits the Sun at a distance that's not too hot nor too cold for liquid water to exist on the surface. Where Goldilocks zone lies depends on the energy output of the star in question. Around a red dwarf, a relatively cold star, a planet orbiting the distance of Mercury could be Earth-like. Likewise, when our Sun becomes a red giant, the Goldilocks zone will be around Jupiter. Now, being in the zone does not guarantee liquid water. There needs to be a source of water in the first place. Scientists are not really sure where our water comes from. It seems logical that any surface water that may have been on Earth originally was evaporated away when the planet was, well, a molten protoplanet. Even after the Earth cooled the first time, a major complicating factor was the massive collision of Earth with an object the size of Mars, we call Theia. This event, beyond spewing out enough material to form the Moon, well, it would have returned Earth back to a molten mass of rock, evaporating any water that may have been there. This is why it's broadly thought that water on Earth was actually delivered here during the Great Bombardment, a period in Earth's history where asteroids, meteorites, and comets were extremely plentiful and readily crashed into the early Earth. These bombarding bodies brought with them all the water that now exists on the planet, or so we think. Technically, Mars and Venus falls in the Goldilocks zone. Why are they so different from Earth? Well, on the one hand, there's Venus, which at some point in its life developed a runaway greenhouse effect. That is, the warming planet produced a thick cloud cover that was insulating, meaning less heat absorbed by the Sun escaped back into space, which created more cloud, less heat loss, at a point where we now have a surface temperature in Venus of almost 500 degrees Celsius and a surface pressure of 92 times that here on Earth. There could be rivers of molten lead on Venus. How exotic must life be if it were to exist there? And before you rage on about greenhouse effect, One must remember the Earth would be a snowball if it were not for this effect. Sans greenhouse, our surface temperature would be about minus 16 degrees. That said, thanks to climate change, we may be flirting with what I'm going to call the Venus effect. So essentially, Venus boiled its liquid water away. At the other extreme, Mars didn't so much boil it away, but had it evaporate away. We all know with certainty that Mars at one time had liquid oceans. However, Mars lacks a magnetic field like Earth that protects our atmosphere from the solar winds. These winds, over time, stripped Mars of its atmosphere, an atmosphere that eventually contained all of its water. And when it went, so went all the water, or at least most of it. As I said, we know there is some water subsurface on Mars, but Mars has no atmosphere really to speak about. So even if a planet orbits in its Goldilocks zone, it may still lack the necessary ingredients of life. But let's take a positive stance and assume a planet in the zone is likely to have water. Are there any planets beyond our solar system, exoplanets, that are in its star's Goldilocks zone? Yes, there are a handful of candidates. But now we explore some other criteria of life. Most of these planets aren't suitable for other reasons. Most of the planets we know about are classified as gas giants. That is, they are composed mostly of, well, gas. Think Jupiter. We can rule out these planets as possibilities because another probable criteria for life is a solid surface. Why? Well, the chemistry needed for life to occur requires a location for reaction, a place for it to occur. If there's no primordial pool or clay rock for the chemistry reactions to occur, well, life as we know it just couldn't arise. Another class of planets that have been discovered in increasing number are just plain giants. The reason the giants are found more readily is that with most techniques used, the larger the planet is, the easier it is to find. The greater the mass, the bigger the wobble. The bigger the planet, the more light it blocks out when transiting its star. Smaller, Earth-sized planets may be very common, but they're also a lot harder to detect. So this next class of planets being found in large numbers in the habitable zone are what are termed super-Earths. These are planets that are 5 to 10 times larger than Earth. Some of these are also unlikely to harbor life because they're also referred to as mini-Neptunes. That is, they're gaseous planets, just on a smaller scale than Jupiter. That said, there are a few that are believed to be rocky worlds like our own. In fact, some researchers have pointed out that a planet about twice our size would be more conductive to life due to a thicker atmosphere and better resource recycling. There have been a few planets that exist in the habitable zone and are Earth-like in size, but our knowledge of these are still primitive at best. We know of their existence and we know their orbital location, but beyond that, it's sort of guesswork. Even though it may seem planets similar to Earth are rare, the Kepler mission leaders estimate from their data that there are likely 40 billion, yes, that's billion with a B, Earth-like planets in the Milky Way alone. Okay, so I think I can make the claim that life on another planet is likely, and yes, with all the standard caveats understood. Statistically, it would seem bizarre that there was no life out there, especially when we consider that life on planets occur almost immediately after acceptable cooling takes place. The Earth was born 4.5 billion years ago. The first signs of life can be found around 3.7 billion years ago. And if those odds were not enough to sway you, I might point out that even in our own solar system, there are four moons that may be hospitable to life as we know it, and one, Titan, as we don't know it. If you extrapolate out of that, well, there are likely trillions of places life could arise in our galaxy. And on that positive note, let's take another break, and we'll return with exploring the idea of intelligent life.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
And we're back. Okay, we've pretty much reasoned our way into assumption that life is likely common in the universe. When my cohorts and I were talking, we were thinking aliens. The term alien, in context, didn't refer to some bacterium or even some Fuzzy flying Staphylococcus. No, alien was in reference to intelligent life. So could there be intelligent life beyond Earth? Well, that of course raises another question. What qualifies as intelligent life? It is well documented that chimps are intelligent. Whales and dolphins exhibit higher order thinking. Dogs are intuitive. Hell, crows use tools to get food. Mice can be taught to run mazes. These are all kinds of intelligence. But no, of course, we mean people kind of intelligence. And even there, we have to be specific. It is conceivable that you could have a highly intelligent form of life that lives in water. They may have literature that makes Shakespeare read like a late-night commercial. They may have fifth-dimensional mathematics. But as water worlds, it seems unlikely they could perceive technology as we do. Think about it. Is it possible to have a combustion engine in a world without any solid land? So again, it's not intelligence per se, but technological intelligence we're looking for. And even then, we as a species are distinguished by our curiosity. We seek innovation. We are an extroverted species. We like to be seen and heard. And well, that we've been doing on a galactic scale for decades now. But more on that later. No, there is a possibility, perhaps a likelihood, that other species on distant planets do not wish to explore the universe. In that case, the odds of us seeing them would be almost impossible. Basically, we're looking for curious, technological, extroverted alien life. And we have about 40 billion planets to look for. Mayhaps trillions of worlds, including moons, etc. Although again, now that I think about it, most of those moons would be aquatic subterranean variety and not likely the kind of candidates we'd be looking for. So is there a mathematical way to calculate the number of aliens of the kind we wish to make contact with? Well, this is where I could introduce you to the Drake equation, named after radio astronomer Frank Drake. Put basically, it's an estimate to guesstimate on the number of stars that form, the number of planets that arrive, the chances of life, the chance of intelligent life, how long they've been around, blah, blah, blah. You put all these numbers in and you get out a number that represents the likely number of possible alien species out there. Some of this information are actual estimates. We have a good handle now on star formation and planetary population, but some of them are guesstimates, like the chances of life arising or technology. So Kepler provides us with 40 billion planets that could have life on it. Considering the rapid evolution of life on Earth, it's likely that close to 100% of those actually do have life on them. And that number could be bolstered if, optimistically speaking, we find signs of life on Mars or Europa. Now for a true science fiction moment, the number of those planets on which intelligent life evolved is likely very low. Of the billions of life forms that have arose here on Earth, the jellyfish, T-Rex, mammoth, rabbits, so far only one has developed intelligent life. So on Earth, it seems the likelihood of intelligence of the kind we're looking for is exceedingly rare. That said, taken as a whole, of all the planets with life on them that we know of, 100% have evolved intelligent life of the type that we're looking for. Again, our sample size is one, the Earth. With the caveats I have previously mentioned, it seems intelligent creatures such as ourselves will inevitably develop technology that would enable space communications, if not space travel, possible. And we've done both. In fact, we've been unwittingly broadcasting our existence for almost a century now. But more on that later. And lastly, what is the life expectancy of an alien race? We know that the average life expectancy of a species on Earth is measured in millions of years. The Homo lineage, of which humans are a part of, think of Homo erectus, Homo habilis, etc. Well, they have a species life expectancy that's measured in hundreds of thousands of years. And we, Homo sapiens, have been around for about 100 or 200,000 years. Drake himself came up with the number of about 34 million alien races in outer space. This thought gave birth to SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. SETI has been listening for those little green men since the 60s, with an ever-expanding resource and observatories. How many of us have SETI screensavers on our PCs? And how many have we discovered so far? None. Well, that may lead us to another question. How are we looking? We've already mentioned how we find planets. But we need to do better than say, hey, that's about the right size and place. No, two, and I don't want to say confirm, but the proper scientific term, probability of life seems weak, but weak we must be. So what signs of life could we detect out there? First, we could try and see if there's atmospheric water. But as we've kind of said, water seems common. We should look for a more reliable indicator. Can we find oxygen or methane? You see, these two chemicals love each other to the point where they will combine to the point of making one or the other extinct. So if we see a planet with both, something must be replacing or recycling them. Something we find here on Earth done by life. But how will we know these chemicals are present? Well, there's this thing called spectroscopy, the study of light spectrum, in particular light given off by distant objects. You see, light, white light, as we have heard perhaps before, is not one color but a combination of all colors, blue, green, red. Well, black is the absence of color. Astronomers have for decades been using this method for assessing the chemical composition of stars, our neighboring planets, etc. That said, there's no such thing as pure white light because various elements or chemicals will absorb particular parts of the spectrum. This changes the color. A spectrograph is a graph of every color frequency, and a lot can be learned by its peaks and valleys. For example, take a burning flame that appears white. With the addition of copper, suddenly the light turns green. This is because copper emits more green light than others. This will create a blip at a particular frequency we see as green. Then let's fill the room with nitrous oxide. The light will appear brownish red. This is because nitrous oxide is absorbing all but those color frequencies, creating valleys on our graph. So a spectrograph of an element or a chemical is unique to them. It's like a fingerprint to us. When we look at a spectrograph of a distant star, we can read those spectral lines and see not only what a star is composed of, what the source of light is, but also whatever material that light has traveled through to get here. Okay, some of you might say, Neptune isn't a star. How can we use this process to see it? Well, true, but it does reflect enough light from the sun that we can actually detect the composition of the planet. We can also see stars shining through Neptune's atmosphere to gain this information. Now, as useful as this method would be for us to detect life signs on other planets, due to a few technical reasons, the planets that we would observe would either be too close to the sun or too far away from the sun and not fall into that Goldilocks zone. So it seems unlikely we could actually see them. But if we cannot see them, maybe we could hear them. As I mentioned earlier, we as a species have been letting the universe know that intelligent life exists on Earth for decades now, unintentionally via our radio transmission. For instance, when the CBC is broadcasting on radio, by the way, is anyone still using radio over the airs anymore? Well, in the past, radio waves originated at a radio station where it transmitted over the air to portable radios. This was, or still largely is, omnidirectional. That is, it not only goes out horizontally across the land, but also goes up into space, where our transmissions may have provided entertainment for countless aliens, well, those within the 80 or so light year radius of our signals. On a side note, you may have noticed that I placed the start of our interstellar broadcasting to the mid-1930s. Well, arguably the first audio broadcast was in 1906. The first radio transmission believed to be strong enough to be interstellar was the 1936 Olympic Games, broadcast globally, and it seems beyond. For those not steeped in obvious history, this was the Berlin Games, hosted by Nazi Germany. So if aliens were listening, the very first item heard from Earth was the opening ceremonies featuring the oratory of the infamous Adolf Hitler. What do they say about first impressions? So, have we heard them? As mentioned earlier, SETI has been listening for decades with only one wow event, and that, having not been repeated, was likely something else. Think about it. We've been broadcasting for a mere 80 years, but we have been, quote, intelligent life for thousands of years. Perhaps intelligence on alien worlds have not yet developed to radio or laser communication technology. Maybe we're too early. On the opposite side, maybe if we were listening 1,000 years ago, we would have heard them. It's possible they have developed past primitive radio technology and used tachyons or something, which we currently are unable to hear. So given our previous conjecture, the question still remains. If there are millions of aliens in outer space, why have we not heard them? Perhaps we should revisit the assumption. We have not heard them. That infers that they have tried to communicate with us. It could be instead that they thought a visit is a better form of first contact. There have been many people claiming to have encounters with aliens. Maybe they're here already. Well, again, being very human-centric, if we traveled the billions of miles to visit an alien world, we would likely say hi or something. And if we're going to say hi, We wouldn't do it to some country bumpkin late at night or on some deserted road. No, we would be much more likely to address the UN or some global broadcast about how we come in peace or something. No, I think you could classify alien visitors into three groups. The unambiguous type, those who shout, "We're here!" They would make their presence well known and unmistakable. Then there are the aloof type, the "we don't care if you know or not." From their intellectual perspective, we may seem like curiosities with, you know, really colorful nesting behavior or something. We might even make entertaining pets. They may not shout out their presence, but they make no effort to hide themselves, and thus again, their arrival would probably be obvious. The third classification is the Star Trek type. Those who want to remain hidden to observe and not to interfere with our development or something. Think Prime Directive. They would take special efforts to not be seen, to remain concealed, and thus would not probe rednecks in the outback or whatever part of the anatomy they might choose to probe. Now, if they were here, we would likely know about it, at least in my humble opinion. But of course, that presents a problem, known as the Fermi paradox. The apparent contradiction between the high estimate of the probability of the existence of extraterrestrial civilizations and humanity's lack of contact with or evidence of such civilizations. If you adhere to this thought, the Earth should already be colonized or at least visited. So if the universe is awash with intelligent life, where are they? Why aren't the skies full of their broadcasts? Well, first, if we revisit the Drake equation, it could be that intelligent life is just extremely rare, that we may be the only ones in the universe, as depressing as that thought is. It may not, however, be that bleak. Intelligence may arise, but infrequently. So while there are many, if not a lot of intelligent aliens out there, there is a limiting factor as why we don't hear them. This may be as simple as intelligent life has a tendency to extinguish itself. We have in the last century come close to nuking ourselves to oblivion. Climate change is another attempt to expunge this planet of the virus called humanity. So it may be that the life expectancy of intelligent life is low and the odds of two civilizations arising at the same time still lower. On a more sinister note, there may be an ancient race, which, as an act of preservation, has actively wiped out any burgeoning alien civilization to prevent those new life forms from destroying the established race. And that leads nicely into our final question. Should we be looking at all? It has been proffered by no greater mind than Stephen Hawking that we should not want to meet an alien race because it is likely that it wouldn't work out good for us humans. If we take our own history as reference, every time we have traveled to an alien world, albeit on Earth, the Americas, Australia, Europeans to Africa, it was to colonize those lands or extract whatever value we could find there, often enough subjugating the indigenous population to help expedite this extraction. We have a long and sad history of genocide when we meet people who are not as technologically advanced as ourselves. An alien civilization able to conquer the problem of interstellar space travel would likely have little trouble conquering us. There's also the possibility that a sufficient advanced technology would not recognize us as intelligent life, any more than we acknowledge tool-using crows as intelligent. Cute, but just a lowly animal. And even if there are more benevolent types, we could still be doomed, in a way. In more enlightened times, when we have encountered the prehistoric tribes in the Amazon that have somehow managed to have no contact with modern civilization, we have attempted to keep our distance. We've sent in anthropologists and sociologists to make first contact in a way that would protect these archaic tribes. Again, I hate to use this language, but it may be one day used on us. First contact with these primitive cultures, well, it seems to have failed. There are those who are greedy and echo our violent past and exploit the land for profit. There's also the magic factor. When a technology is sufficiently advanced, it appears to be magic. During World War II, many Pacific Islanders' first contact was with the American Air Force, who were laying down landing strips. This led to what was called the cargo cults. These locals saw the Yanks as gods who could fly and worshiped them. How would we react to interstellar travelers? It may be we should stop looking, cover our tracks so they can't find us. Well, due to those radio transmissions, I think the cat's out of the bag. That said, from what we've discovered during the show, we are far more likely to find alien pen pals than visitors. That is, our only interaction with them would be radio transmissions, which would likely be carried out over years or decades. so we'll be able to talk with them, but perhaps never travel the distance required to visit them. And there would be so much to be gained from such a pen pal contact. Not only could we exchange technology, but we could improve our prospects of finding other aliens. Why? As already mentioned, the only data point we have for life is ourselves. By doubling our data, we would likely double our chances of finding another. This alien network could then advance exponentially, and at the same rate, making travel to distant worlds a greater possibility, and without the risks I've listed above, because each race would be more or less on an equal technological footing. Now, as I pointed out, the traveling part is unlikely, and that underlies the reason we should not be afraid of first contact, our ultimate natural defense of a sort, and that is space, and the astronomical, to forgive the pun, distances involved. We are unable to truly conceive how vast space is. Try to grasp the vastness in your mind. Got it? Well, no, it is many, 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 many times more vast than that. From our perspective, space is infinite. If you consider the fact that it takes light about 12 minutes to travel the distance between Earth and Mars, and it takes us over a year to travel that same distance in a spaceship, the most distant spacecraft we've ever launched, Voyager 1, which has been on its adventure for almost 40 years, is some 20 trillion kilometers away, or a measly 18 light hours distance. In another 300 years, it will reach the inner part of the Oort cloud, a ring of asteroids and comets that orbit the Earth. It will be about 30,000 years before it exits the Oort cloud, the psychological, if not physical, boundary of our solar system. The nearest star would take us twice that time. If we learned to travel 100 times faster, no, let's make it 1,000 times faster, it would still take us 180 years to get to the nearest planet with the possibility of life, which is about 16 light years away. Put in another way, with human perspective, it would take Voyager 18 million years to get there. What would we even be in that amount of time? Speaking of time, I could talk about this for hours, but alas, we're limited to only one. So I'll end it here. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truth.
Feeling good on Wednesday.